Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire is hosted by myself, Courtney Harrop, in Powell River on the traditional territories of the Tla'amin Nation and produced by CKUT Radio Broadcasting from Montreal on unceded Mohawk territory. In this episode...
For me, you know, politics and activism has never been separated.
Manitoba health tax dollars are going to go into the pockets of companies in Ontario. It's not right.
But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from Gennarji O'Sullivan at Vancouver Co-op Radio with news on the 60 Scoop class action procedures before the courts.
So in retrospect, how did the residential school agreement work and how did it fail the residential school survivors from your perspective?
I think we won the war and lost the peace. By that I mean the settlement that we achieved in 2007, and then it was a settlement with the Liberal government, then the Conservatives got elected. And one of the messages is that we negotiated that people could get up to $550,000. There were a handful of people who got in the range of $250,000. I don't think anybody got $300,000 or $400,000, never mind $500,000.
Lawyer Tony Merchant led the class action lawsuit for residential school survivors through the courts. He is currently pursuing representation for a class action suit for 60 Scoop survivors. Here is Co-op Radio's Gennarji O'Sullivan in conversation on the latest updates with Mr. Merchant.
How do you plan to protect the adoptees within this application process if you are in fact successful in being the leader in this application?
There are two parts of what happened in 60 Scoop. So there's a part which is loss of culture, and the advertisements that they did were television advertisements, and the real name of the program in most jurisdictions was Adopt Indian Métis. So the very program was to take Indian and Métis children and make them white, which is exactly the same as the reason behind Indian residential schools. That's an area of compensation, and we're working with the federal government, trying to get the federal government. Federal government has announced that they're prepared to consider compensation about that. There have been meetings. They've announced there will be meetings. And I attend the meetings and other lawyers attend the meetings. There's a second part of what happened in 60 Scoop, and that was that just as with residential schools, many people were then put in the way of danger and they were sexually and physically abused. That's another battle. We've had a lot of meetings, but we're kind of in early days on trying to move to a settlement of those two things.
Mr. Merchant also explained, because of legal constraints, the current suit will not seek compensation for intergenerational survivors of the 60 Scoop.
Thanks to Co-op Radio for that headline. Our next headline reports on a Black Lives Matter action that took to the streets of Toronto.
Demanding a home in Canada for Beverly Bram, Black Lives Matter Toronto occupied during rush hour Yonge and Bloor, one of the city's busiest intersections. Bram, a Jamaican woman, is an immigration detainee, mother and wife to Canadian citizens. Currently in a sponsorship process with Immigration Canada, Bram and her young child were recently detained and her deportation booked. Regarding Bram's case, Black Lives Matter activists point to a history of bias and racism within Canada's immigration system. According to the press release issued by the group, on the day of the intersection occupation, Beverly Bram must stay because, quote, black families matter. Letters of support are being mobilized by Black Lives Matter Toronto. Check out their Facebook page for more information.
Up next, Michael Welch from CKUW offers Groundwire listeners an update on the two-month-old blockade on the Parker lands in Winnipeg. heavy machinery is once again chewing up the much-beloved patch of Winnipeg urban forest known as the Parker Lands after a September 14th court decision granted an injunction against environmental and social justice advocates occupying the site. The ruling came exactly 2 months after the self-described land defenders set up the camp to prevent further demolition of the green space. As reported in a previous installment of Groundwire, Andrew Marquess, owner of Gem Equities, had received the Parker lands through a controversial land swap with the city back in the summer of 2009, with the understanding that he would construct hundreds of housing units on the property. The terms of the arrangement were that, before proceeding with any development, the landholder would have to supply a development plan, which has so far not been forthcoming. In spite of the setback, protectors of the Parker lands are not giving up the fight. On Thursday, September 21st, two of the campers filed a notice of application on behalf of fellow blockaders, demanding a judicial review of the 2009 land swap decision. The notice also maintains that the clear-cutting and destruction of the forested area constitute unauthorized development and that the city has an obligation to enforce its own laws.
My name's Nancy Thomas. They deemed this land surplus improperly. It had been deemed ecologically sensitive by the city in 2000-2001. That's supposed to have been registered on the land title. I don't know if it was or not, but it's not anymore. And it was deemed surplus. Oh, the city doesn't need that. But then it turned out in 2015, 2016, they did. I think it all needs to be reviewed in the public interest so people know what happened.
A case conference has been called for the morning of Tuesday, September 26th, to determine how the matter will proceed. In the meantime, more of the Parker lands is being pulverized on behalf of developer Marquess, with land defenders looking on helplessly from behind chain link fence. That report was supplied by Michael Welch from Winnipeg-based campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM. Background on the Parker lands and the efforts to protect it can be found at the site decolonize.ca. That's it for the headlines. Groundwire will be right back after this.
We'll be right back.
You were just listening to O Canada by Russell Wallace.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Now it's time for our feature stories. British Columbia is in the middle of significant political change. This summer, the BC NDP took power for the first time in 17 years, and the province's biggest city, Vancouver, has a by-election with several activist candidates eager to make their mark. Groundwire reporter Rohit Joseph spoke to two of those candidates about what this by-election means for the city and the impact that they hope to make.
On October 14th, Vancouverites will have the opportunity to choose a new city councillor. Former Vision Party councillor Jeff Meggs left his position in City Hall after being selected as Premier John Horgan's chief of staff, prompting this October's by-election. Six of the nine candidates in this by-election have been involved in some form of social justice advocacy or activism. The parties include the Vision Party, that's the party of Mayor Gregor Robertson, the Green Party, the NPA, and the One City Party. The rest of the candidates are independent. I spoke with two of these candidates, both with impressive activist credentials.
Yeah, so I'm Jean Swanson. I'm running for city council as an independent and the election on October 14th.
Jean Swanson is a veteran anti-poverty activist in Vancouver's downtown east side. She convinced the city to improve safety standards in low-income housing and helped secure funding for a vital community center. Swanson received the Order of Canada last year for her work.
So my name is Diego Cardona. I'm Vision Vancouver City Council candidate for the upcoming October 14 by-election.
Diego Cardona is 21 years old, but has already made a name for himself as an activist. He co-founded Fresh Voices, an organization that helps connect government services with the needs of newcomers and refugees. Cardona is the Vision Party's youngest candidate to run for city council. I asked them both about their transition from activism to politics.
For me, you know, politics and activism has never been separated. I think there's like electoral politics and activism, which might be different things. But in the groups that I've been part of and the organizations that I've worked for as a paid staffer, we've always encouraged young people and communities to also step up and lead and show that you can develop better policy when you have as many voices as possible around the decision-making table.
When I started getting active in the early 70s, was about the time that the right wing and the corporate think tanks started pushing for policies that make the rich richer and the poor poorer, and pushing austerity policies and pushing for policies that cut services and programs for ordinary people and cut taxes for the rich. And so that is a very powerful force. And so most of what I've done, I haven't really seen a lot of benefit because the corporate forces have been so strong.
So what gives? Why does there seem to be this undercurrent of activism in this by-election?
Well, I think the theme is that Vancouver is a diverse city, not just demographically speaking, but politically speaking, you know. Folks are active.
What I'm sensing now is that there's a turning with Sanders in the U.S., Bernie Sanders and Corbyn in the U.K., and all these young folks here are just saying enough is enough.
Any young person in Vancouver knows how challenging it can be to live here. I asked Jean what she believes are the biggest issues for young folks.
Their rents, right? They're all living with their parents. Their jobs are all precarious. They have two and three and four jobs. They can't afford transit. Something needs to change.
Cardona was a student just a few years ago at UBC. He could be the youngest person elected for his party. I wanted to know, what could he do for students in Vancouver?
I know the pains of going to UBC during rush hour. I understand and I empathize with anyone who does that. So I think championing the Broadway subway line for me is a priority. Obviously, we need affordable housing for folks, more rental housing for people. We need more rental housing for students. Gregor Robertson, you know, has delivered a housing reboot plan that clearly says, you know, what affordable means. It clearly states that there'll be units that are clearly attached to people's income, so we can support people at the lower side of the income bracket and in the middle side of the income bracket. I think that would benefit students directly.
Voter turnout is relatively low in Vancouver's civic elections, with turnout hovering well below 50%. By-elections tend to fare worse. So I wanted to hear from both candidates what's at stake in this by-election.
We cannot afford to move backwards. I think that's what's really at stake in this by-election. Do we send a message that we want to continue to build a modern, new, progressive, affordable, and green Vancouver?
People are feeling the impact of 40 years of austerity, and they're saying we have to fight back now. And it's not just the austerity, it's also the planet frying. We really need to take bold action on climate change, and the city should be part of that.
Reporting for Groundwire, that was CITR 101.9 FM's Rohit Joseph speaking with Vancouver by-election candidates Diego Cardona and Jean Swanson. If you are in Vancouver, you can learn more about voting in the by-election at www.vancouver.ca. The healthcare system in Manitoba is undergoing a major overhaul under the new Progressive Conservative government. Looming closures of emergency rooms, the privatization of some services, layoffs, a healthcare premium, and public sector wage freezes are all being considered as the new Tory government attempts to implement cost-saving measures. Michael Welch from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg brings us this report on how workers and patients alike are confronting this unprecedented austerity drive and putting care before cuts.
Wednesday, September 13th. A noon-hour rally in front of the Manitoba Legislative Building draws hundreds of people concerned about the Manitoba government's proposed overhaul of the province's healthcare system. The Progressive Conservatives under the leadership of Brian Pallister were elected to power in 2016. In order to tackle budgetary constraints, including the loss of health transfers from the federal government in coming years, the new government has chosen to embark on what has been called the most sweeping healthcare change in the province in a generation. The Pallister government is instituting cuts in health spending. As a result, Winnipeggers are bracing for changes that include the closure of 3 out of 6 emergency rooms in the city, the closure of 4 out of 5 quick care clinics staffed primarily by nurse practitioners, the privatization of air ambulances and MRIs, and the introduction of a health care premium, or tax, proportioned by income. The Wednesday noon hour rally was organized by the Manitoba Government and General Employees Union, or MGEU, which represents 16,000 healthcare workers in the province. Michelle Garwanski is the union president.
Well, the first thing I can tell you is that the government's going too far too fast. There doesn't seem to be a good plausible plan in place. So, for example, at the Vic Hospital, they laid off 155 staff there. They've given them their deletion letters. We know that there's only 115 jobs open, so that tells us that 40 people are going to lose their jobs. So we've got members that are 30-year veterans doing the jobs that they've been doing. Very skilled, very, very productive, and very proud of the services they provide to Manitobans that don't have a clue what's going to happen to them on October the 3rd.
Lisa Tarko draws her insights into the proposed healthcare changes not only by her past as a home care worker, but also as a client of healthcare services.
I had to retire due to illness because I have a respiratory condition, a chronic one. Well, because I can't breathe, I need the emergency. If I'm having an attack or something, I have to get an ambulance and I have to go to emerge. There are times when I have to stay in the hospital. And I was quite comfortable over at the community hospital, and that's not going to happen anymore with me. I'm going to have to go to the St. Boniface Hospital, which is a bigger hospital. And I'm kind of concerned that I'm going to be lost in the system there.
The healthcare changes have supposedly been informed by 3 studies. 1, a comprehensive review of healthcare delivery in Manitoba commissioned by the previous NDP government, and 2, KPMG reports, which have yet to be made public. The decision to institute changes without any ability to inspect these reports is of particular concern to healthcare workers and patients alike.
If they would have made that accessible to the public, maybe we would be more aware of where these cuts are coming from, what motivates them, how come they're doing exactly what they're doing, and stuff like that.
On Wednesday, September 20th, the Pallister government announced that two Ontario-based corporations, WeCare and ParaMed, would be contracted to deliver home care services to patients leaving hospital. This would replace a publicly funded program cut last spring to save the province money. Garonski does not believe such privatization schemes will save the province money in the long term.
Manitoba health tax dollars are going to go into the pockets of companies in Ontario. It's not right. And we know from the 90s, this government back then actually tried a trial basis on private home care in 1998. Their own report, it was Progressive's Conservative government report that came back, stating that it was not cost effective and the care declined drastically.
Michelle Garonski believes that people working in the system have some ideas on how to meet budgetary challenges without compromising healthcare in Manitoba. She's not impressed by the Pallister government's apparent lack of interest in working with the stakeholders themselves.
I've been working in healthcare for 33 years before I became the president of the union. Some of us have a little bit more experience than someone that's just been elected a year ago. Come and talk to us. That's all we want to do. Talk to us. Slow this down. Let's work together to improve services for our fellow Manitobans. That's what we're wanting to do.
From Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
The voices you heard in that report include Michelle Goronsky, president of the Manitoba Government Employees Union, Lisa Tarko, a healthcare client, and voices from a September 13th rally in front of the Manitoba Legislative Building captured by a community videographer, Paul Graham, which can be found at the Paul S. Graham YouTube channel. Thanks to CKUW for contributing that feature to Groundwire, your source for community radio news from the grassroots. New editions available bi-weekly online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Time for our community radio report, brought to us by CKUT Radio with audio files from WOOC-FM. The Grassroots Radio Conference, or GRC 2017, will take place October 6th to 9th in Albany, New York. The event is the latest gathering of the Grassroots Radio Coalition and will convene community radio stations from across North America for workshops, panels, and discussions. This year's gathering is hosted by WCAALP 107.3 FM, a locally owned and independent low-power community radio station operated by the nonprofit Grand Street Community Arts Organization. Here is Musa Zwana, the volunteer station manager of WCAALP and a local organizer for the 2017 Grassroots Radio Conference.
So the Grassroots Radio Coalition is a tight, loose group of radio activists who help to build stations, help to maintain stations, and help to develop stations. And they, a lot of them, you know, they'll have their own stations that they work at, but a lot of them are also consultants and engineers that do this kind of work. And they come together every year along with broadcasters from across the country, broadcasters and activists, and put together this grassroots radio conference, which is really more based around community radio stations as opposed to, say, public broadcast stations, which are kind of more funded. These are a lot of nonprofit, not as much religious, but nonprofit and community stations.
What tend to be the goals and priorities of this conference, and what role does it play in creating and maintaining grassroots radio communities and networks?
You know, I feel like it's what we were just talking about, you know, keeping this process of, you know, free speech and community radio alive. And the conference allows people to get together, you know, because everybody's spread out all over the country. You know, we'll have people coming from Washington. We'll have people coming from Kentucky. We'll have people coming from Canada. We've got people coming from Florida. We got people coming from Detroit. And when you come to the conference, I went to the conference 3 years ago in Ames, Iowa, and I feel like I've been a part of the community ever since. And the Grassroots Radio Conference, you know, that's really what it's about. You know, it's that one time of year to get together and be able to hold those formal workshops, those formal panels, you know, talk about what issues are going on, you know, currently as well, too.
Right. That sounds like quite a diversity of people from many regions and states.
We're finalizing our workshops. We do have our keynote speaker, Laura Flanders, from the Laura Flanders Show, independent talk show host. We're blessed to have her as our keynote speaker. But if you go to the website, you know, grassrootsradioconference.org, you will start to see, you know, over the next few days, next couple of weeks, you'll start to see the workshops getting published, and you'll see what a great lineup we've got.
CKUT volunteers from Montreal will be attending this year's GRC. Here is Candace Moores from the CKUT Prison Radio Show speaking about her hopes for traveling to Albany to participate in the GRC.
Hello, my name is Candace, and I'm one of the collective members currently involved in producing the Prison Radio Show at CKUT FM in Montreal. I am mainly interested in attending the Grassroots Radio Conference in Albany, New York this year, mainly to meet and connect with fellow radio journalists and also meet with prison activists. CKUT can be heard in upstate New York, where there are also many, many prisons. And a couple of our contributing members are even incarcerated in upstate New York. So we are particularly interested in a radio that traverses borders, radio across borders, and that also transcends, reaches across prison walls.
You can learn more about the 2017 Grassroots Radio Conference online at www.grassrootsradioconference.org. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUT Radio on unceded Mohawk territory in Montreal. I have been your host, Courtney Harrop, in Powell River on the traditional territories of the Shaman Nation.
Music this week was O Canada by Russell Wallace.
Headlines this episode were written by Michael Welch and Gretchen King. We thank all of our contributors. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at www.groundwirenews.ca.